just say it's great to be back. Appreciate all the prayers that were offered on my behalf for safe travel. There was a moment or two where a few of my family members were driving the car, and I wasn't sure how the Lord was going to answer those prayers, but nevertheless, I am back safe and sound, and I had a fantastic vacation. It really was needed, I think, more than I thought it was. And I'm able to come back now and have a renewed vigor and appreciation for the work that we do here. And I'm happy to be back. Happy to see all your faces. I forget how much I miss your faces until I get back. Well, a little bit while. Anyway, I hate that I missed last week's study. There was a lot of good questions in there. Whoever recorded that, thank you for recording that particular audio file. This week, we are covering verses 11 through 21. Appreciate Cole reading and backing up into verse 7 there, getting a fuller context of what we're going to be discussing here tonight. Who had the last question last week? Lovingly. Okay, so first question then is going to be for Bart. Now, I've divided them into their respective questions here. Question A, what is our motivation for loving our brethren? And B, with what kind of love are we supposed to love them? Verse 11.
Well, I think A is an easy answer, and that is Jesus. Jesus is our motivation. 1 John 3:16, by this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we also ought to lay down our lives for our brethren. So we only know love because of the revelation of God to us through Jesus Christ. With what kind of love are we supposed to love them with? So we, in our study at the house, we tried to think of adjectives for this kind of love. And brotherly love was mentioned, a giving love, a sacrificial love, a preferring love. Cole said a preferring love. And so many different ways you can describe the love of we're modeling after Jesus, and all those things describe Jesus. And I also thought of Isaiah 53 and verse 9, he had done no violence. So a non-violent love, Isaiah 53 verse 9, a non-violent love. And of course that means on the surface of it, no physical violence, but as Jesus taught us in the Sermon on the Mount, it is violence to hate your brother. It is murder to hate your brother. So we have to be nonviolent and not seek. There's so many different ways that we as human beings, you know, belittling other people and trying to get an edge up on people and comparing ourselves with other people. And Jesus didn't do any of those things. And he should be our model to try, as we progress through life, to try and eliminate all of those things as we show love to each other.
That last point in particular, I think, is really important, particularly towards the end of our study tonight, verses 19 through 21, that talks about not only our love for God, but our love for our brother. Because how can one say that you love God but don't love your brother? If you say that, then you're a liar. So that's a great point. Other comments here on question number one? Well, again, Mark had some really good adjectives there. I'll add a couple more. So you mentioned sacrificial and giving. It's also a comforting love. It's a love of inclusion. I was trying to think if you mentioned that. Love of inclusion is a love of righteousness. It's not tainted by anything. And this is a type of love that the world would have no knowledge of except for God. This type of love is, frankly, another proof of the existence of God, just the fact that it exists at all. And as it says here, God, Jesus, the Holy Spirit, if you include him in this as well, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. He is the motivation, he is the why, he is the reason for love. Without God, there could be no such love. Bill, yeah.
So that word love is Strong's G25, agapeo, which is to love dearly. So this isn't agape. This is a different kind of love, but it's to love dearly. And those descriptions you gave were right on, I think. And I looked at the first part of this a little different, I suppose. The motivation for loving our brethren. You know, I kind of thought, well, maybe it's the realization that we have a God that loved us first, verse 19, and then maybe realization what God was willing to sacrifice for mankind, that demonstration of love. So maybe I looked at that a little different, but close.
You know, to that point, another adjective would be a non-reciprocal love. The love that God shows, he loved us before we loved him. And he will continue to express his love through the sacrifice of his son to people who don't love him, people who don't even like him or even acknowledge him. And that's the type of love, again, we'll see this later on, verses 19 through 21, and other verses also in our study, but a non-reciprocal love. Anything else? Okay, question number two for Landon, if you'd like it. How do we harmonize Exodus 33, verses 12 through 23, and Moses seeing the glory of God with verse 12 that says, no one has seen God at any time? And B, how do we know that we abide in him? How does God give us of his spirit? That should have been C, but y'all can.
So I don't really have much for part A of this question, so I'll just answer B and C. But how do we know that we abide in him? Well, I guess I'll answer B and C at the same time. Two verses. The answer to this, Ephesians 5, verse 18, 17 to 18. Therefore, do not be unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Do not be drunk with wine, in which is the dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit. And then we have a parallel verse over in Colossians 3, verse 15, I think. Is it? It's not verse 15. It's Colossians 3:16. And it says there, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. So, how do we know if we abide in him? And how does God give us the Spirit? If we study the word and we abide in the word, we know that we abide in God. And this could also be the Spirit you're discussing in our study, that the Spirit could actually be given to us, but we have no idea of knowing that. But we do know that if we study the Word, we abide in God, and we receive the Spirit through the Word.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Yeah, that part we know for sure. Excellent question. If I may, I'm going to go on my little rant here on question A. I remember when I was studying this that I asked a similar question to really the parallel verse in John chapter 1, verse 18, when we studied that, which says basically the same thing, no one has seen God at any time. So in my mind, this is more of a question for me, something that I have asked before, and I felt better studying it this time than I did when we studied John chapter 1. So in this particular account there in Exodus 33, we have Moses that sees the glory of God. He is allowed to see the hind parts of God, as it describes it there in that particular passage, as God walks by. So how can he say here that no one has seen God at any time while someone has seen God? I like what Kaufman said on this. These are his comments for John chapter 1, verse 18, but it equally applies here. It says, this is not a contradiction of Exodus 24, verse 10, which is another passage. It's recorded that the whole company of Israelites saw the God of Israel. Nor is this a contradiction of Job 42, verse 5, where Job said of God, now mine eye seeth thee. Of course, the terminology of these passages is contradictory, because no man hath seen, they saw. That's contradictory. But seeing is not used in the same sense in these passages. As Torrey observed, we must remember that two statements which in terms flatly contradict one another may be both of them absolutely true, for the reason that the two terms are not used in the same sense in the two statements. So for this particular statement here in verse 12, that no one has seen God at any time, It's used differently than we would think that it means. It's not an absolute in the fact that no one has ever seen any evidence of God. Moses did, as he describes there, the Israelites did, Job did. I believe another commentator said that we see God through the person of Jesus Christ. So it's not that no one has seen God in these examples, but it's in the way that he's describing that no one has seen God. And I think in particular, it's describing, he's using this particular verse as a jab to the Gnostics. As a jab to tell them, because they had this idea that with enough knowledge, oh, I can get really close to God. I can get as close to God as I can possibly can. I can see him in that sense. God is a spirit. He's an invisible spirit. And no one can look upon him unless they die. No one has seen God. But then he goes on in here in verse 12, that this is the way that you do see God. If we love one another, God abides in us. And his love has been perfected in us. This is how you see God. So I went on that little thing there. That helped me. And I view this passage or this terminology in the same way that we view like Romans 3:23. For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Immediately our minds jump to the fact, wait, Jesus didn't sin. So how can we conclude that all people have sinned if Jesus didn't sin? Jesus is part of all. Again, it's both things are true. Jesus did not sin, and all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, but they're used in different ways. I bring that to your consideration. Other comments here? Yeah, Lauren.
So in Exodus, as you just mentioned, Moses was only allowed to see God's back. It says in verse 23, you can't see my face and live. Same thing in verse 20. So like Moses and Elijah, in a way, both only partially saw God. I think what we get leading in here is, you know, in the next few verses, John talks about they were witnesses to Jesus, and it's in that manner that we more completely see God and his nature and his love is through Jesus. And I think that's the point, is that back then it was only partial, and that was why there was the prohibition against idols and of making an image of God, is because you can't capture that nature. But Jesus allows us to see that completely. Mm-hmm. And also, to your point, it to the Gnostics, I mean, we have groups, you know, like the Buddhists seeking Shangri-La and so forth. It's much more simpler than that. We can see it.
That's right. Yeah, great comment. Mark?
Yeah, I think what you guys both said is true. Another way to look at it is the sun. You know, you could say that we've seen the sun, but in truth, we really haven't. Because if you stare at the sun for more than just a couple seconds, you're going to lose your vision. And if you certainly were close, you know, we're 93 million miles away or whatever it is, if you were within a close distance to the sun and you were able to survive not being burned to death, then you certainly couldn't look at the sun. It would destroy your retinas. So I think that's the idea, is that no one can take in the full essence of God. Moses was allowed to see just a scant amount of glory. And it's the same way with the sun. We know the sun exists and is doing things because peripherally we see the sun. And the idea is that someday our bodies will be renewed and remade incorruptible. We will be reborn and we will be able to stand at that time in the presence of God.
To that point, yesterday in class, Gareth Reese was, we were in Acts chapter 9, and you mentioned the sun. He was talking about the fact that the glory of God outshone the noonday sun in the middle of the desert. That's the type of glory that God is. So the sun is the best comparison that we have, and we can't even truly see that. How could we ever see and comprehend the glory of God? There's absolutely no way. Other comments? Okay. Question number 3 for Levi, if you like it. Why might John emphasize their witness of Jesus at this point in the book? What does it mean when we confess that Jesus is the Son of God, and what does it mean to know and believe the love of God? Emphasis on the belief.
My dad brought out the point that he had stated this at the beginning of the book, how he had seen Jesus, and now at the end of the book he's saying it again because it's important. Mm-hmm. Because obviously one part of this, a lot of the context of this is the Gnostics, so restating that we have seen Jesus and touched him is important to help take away about this doctrine. What does it mean when we confess that Jesus is the Son of God? I'm going to steal a lot from Kaufman here. He has a quote that's really long, so I'll just skip around. So this is a form of, and now I was making fun of myself because I thought I would memorize how to pronounce this word, but I've forgotten now. But I think it's synecdoche. Mm-hmm. And I remember Bill was talking about it a while ago, and one form of that would be Cleveland won the ball game, as Cole reminded me, is what he said. So Cleveland obviously, it's a team that's playing, not the entirety of Cleveland that won the game. Mm-hmm. And so this statement is kind of like that. So he continues, the primary prerequisites of salvation, the so-called plan of salvation is meant by this. I'll skip to a part that's relevant to the question. As a consequence of such primary obedience, and subsequently to it, the Holy Spirit was given not to make men sons of God, but because upon initial faith and obedience, they became sons of God. So he says there are two possible meanings of John's word here, and both of them may be correct. And he says, number one, he refers to the Christian's obedience of the gospel at the time he became a Christian. The confession of faith is almost identical to Peter's word on Pentecost. Number two, if, as Robert thought, John was speaking of a time in the life of Christians long after the conversion, then he may be saying that his confession, sorry, this word, can be sincerely repeated by a believer that God abides in him and he in God. So, what came to my mind when, what does it mean that we confess that Jesus is the Son of God? This, wasn't really necessarily a chapter, but he confesses us in heaven, too. So, then the last part, what does it mean to know and believe the love of God? Obviously, here you get the Holy Spirit. It's kind of what Calvin was talking about. But, that means that we follow his will, so I'll stop when I ramble.
Not a ramble. That was very good. There's a lot to that question, and other comments here on question number three. Yeah, Bill.
Well, I appreciate the Cleveland reminder. So thinking about Jesus, Jesus is a I kind of thought that maybe John was bringing this up because Jesus was proof of God's love, and then so someone would not be able to see, people can't see divine nature. You can see the effects of divine nature, but you can't see divine nature. And so this is a way, I think, maybe where John was trying to help the people visualize it. You can look over at verse 9 and verse 10, for this is love, in this is love, but that he loved us and sent his son. So we have those things. So I think, I think maybe it was John trying to help them understand better. And it could also, I think that's about enough. Yeah, that's good.
I was once afraid of rambling. I guess I got to check myself. No, that's very good, very good. So Levi's point earlier about synecdoche, about autonomy, that's an important discussion in when you're talking about or debating about one cup. As far as the drinking this cup, it's not talking about sucking down the literal cup of the contents in the cup. So referring to something beyond what is stated. The thing stated is used to refer to something else like the Cleveland, saying Cleveland won, but meaning the Cleveland baseball team.
And I think that's a very good explanation of confessing that Jesus is the Son of God. It's not just saying the words, but it's the power that those words have. When we confess that Jesus is the Son of God, we're not just agreeing with one fact, we're actually agreeing with many facts. One believes that Jesus is the Christ, they are agreeing with the prophets, they're agreeing with the miracles, with the claims of Jesus himself and the apostles, they're agreeing with God, but that's not all, because it's also claiming that Jesus has the authority that he claimed to have. It's not just that we are confessing he is a person or that he exists, it's that he has all authority and that that position comes with Jesus is the Christ, and therefore confession is an acknowledgement that whatever he says goes, that he has the right to judge the world according to his righteousness, that he is right, and that we acknowledge his authority over mankind in our individual lives, and that if what we believe goes against Christ, then he is right and we are wrong. The confession that Jesus Christ is the Son of God is not something that should be taken lightly. Because if we say that and don't follow up with that, and I think basically the whole book of 1 John talks about that. If we say that we have fellowship with God and walk in darkness, we lie and do not the truth, I believe, is how chapter 1 describes that. Or we deceive ourselves, perhaps, is how it is. Anyway, so I appreciate those things. The other thing I want to notice here is on this question, or 3C, the difference between know and believe. So when you look at these two words, they're very, very interesting because they are two different things. To know the love of God is different than believing the love of God. This is actually a really good proof, if you think about it, against mental assent being the basis for faith, being the basis for belief, because knowledge is one thing. That's what the Gnostics claim to have, right? They claim to have knowledge. But what John is saying here is that we have actual knowledge. Our knowledge is based upon testimony. It's based upon witnesses. It's based upon fact. And I think that the reason he brings it up here in this particular part of the book is because of what he said in verse 12. But that knowledge caused the Christians to do something. It caused them to believe. And this means that their knowledge caused them to take action upon what they knew. Both of these words are verbs, by the way, in the Greek. So belief is not just mental assent. It's not just saying or thinking, rather, that I believe in this, that, or the other. Belief has to have action behind it. Hebrews 11, verse 6, I think, brings that out. What they knew caused them to be better. It caused them to confess that Jesus is the Son of God. It caused them to abide in God. It caused them to love one another as God had loved them, and so on and so forth. So, when he says to know the love of God, that's one thing, to have the knowledge. But to believe is to take the action necessary because of the knowledge that you have. Other comments here? Question number 3?
Yeah, just to your point, I was thinking about James. James 2, faith without works. The faith there is the belief in God, but the works is following his commandments. Mm-hmm. And I just like what James says in verse 19 of chapter 2. You believe that there is one God. You do well. But even the demons believe so.
Yeah, no one can tell me that there's not sarcasm in the Bible. That is pure, that verse is pure genius, because there are some people, even today, as they were back then, saying, I believe in God. James is like, okay, that's nice, but you know, the devils believe. The devils know. The devils have knowledge. They know what's going on, but that knowledge didn't cause them to do anything. And in the same way, the Gnostics, they had knowledge, but it didn't cause them to do anything right. And John's saying, we both have knowledge and we have belief. We have action upon the things that we know. Other comments? All right, question number 4. Let's be cold if you want it. How did they perfect love among them? How does having the proper love cause one to have boldness on the day of judgment?
So when it says perfected love, it doesn't mean flawless love. Because you know, all sin and fallen short of the glory of God. We're far, we have far from perfect love. But the Greek word is really meaning like that it's been completed, or that it's been brought to an end, it's been brought to fruition. And then, how does having the proper love? Question B. I kind of struggled with this question, but I'll go for it. I think it's because if you truly understand the love that God has for us, that will produce action in your life, because as the James verse said, you can know that, you can believe that God exists, but if you don't fully wrap your head around how he is all-knowing and that he, in goodness, sent his son to protect us from our salvation, and you don't spend your life dedicated to him, and you just ignore him in your life, then you're not truly understanding that love, not loving him. So it gets us to do continuous action when we truly understand that love. And if we are continuously showing action and love for God, God can help enlighten us on our sin so we can pray for the forgiveness of that sin. So.
Well said. Good job. Good comment. Other comments here on question number 4. You know, to your point there, Cole, if we are doing what we need to be doing,
then as it talks about there, if we have the perfected, the completed, as you rightly pointed out, type of love, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in this world.
If we're doing what we should be doing, we're not going to fear God as our judge. There's an aspect of that we need to have fear towards God as far as respecting him. And respecting his power, but to fear him in the sense that we are afraid constantly that he is going to destroy us, that he's mean, that he is unloving, that's not love.
That's not correct love. And it reminded me, if we're doing what is right, then we can have assurance that God is on our side. God is abiding in us, as this book has talked about. And as far as having boldness in the day of judgment, I came up with a couple of examples. One was when I worked at Walmart. And you all probably have this in the jobs that you have too, but whenever the big manager came in, everybody scurried around and started cleaning stuff up, right? Because when the big manager comes in, when the judgment comes, you have to make sure everything, all the nooks and crannies, no violations are being committed at that time, even though they had been committed, as long as he was there and everything looked fine, that's all they cared about. They had fear of judgment. I was thinking about the same thing when we're driving. How, I know for myself, trying to do better at this, but sometimes I get to driving and I set the cruise and I'm not really thinking about it. All of a sudden I see a cop on the side of the road. And he's slamming your brakes, right? Everyone slams on the brakes. They start, maybe they pull their seatbelt down, and, you know, suddenly we're 10 and 2 drivers and everybody's doing exactly what they're supposed to do. Fear of judgment, because you're not doing that which is right. And to me, it's the same thing here. If you're doing that which is right, you can have boldness in the day of judgment. Not that we have boldness in and of ourselves, that we are so good, but because of our belief in Jesus the Christ, because we have obeyed the gospel, because we have done to the best of our ability that which God has commanded us to do, there shouldn't be a reason for us to be afraid. Bill?
I wanted to share this. I found this in my reading, that second part, how does having the proper love cause one to have boldness on the day of judgment? Boldness is confidence, assurance. That's what boldness is. And the more we increase in love and we perfect it, the less we have to fear on the judgment day. Well, that's kind of easy to say, but when we think, if you can, as Cole said, wrap your mind around standing before the Lord to be judged, you know, we might be satisfied to just merely survive and move on to paradise, to heaven, the day of judgment. But God wants us to fill our lives with His love and truth, and then we're able to be a conduit to others. This love of God coming through the Lord through us to share that love with others and be an encouragement to others. In sharing that love and truth with others, to me, that's where we, when we are able to demonstrate more and more, that's when we have to have, we should be able to have that confidence, boldness. And it's still hard to wrap your mind around such a big thing, standing before the Lord. But He's wanting us to have that kind of love that gives us that encouragement. Mm-hmm. And I heard another scenario I was wanting to share. If you think of God's love, if you think about a pipe that carries water, if that water doesn't come out the other end of the pipe, that pipe's of no value. So if we imagine God's love coming through that pipe and coming to us, the Lord expects us then to continue to distribute that love to others.
That's a good analogy. I really like that. Have a comment here, question number four? Cool.
I was going to say something about what you were talking about earlier with just having so much fear for God. I mean, it's important that we have fear for God, but we're all supposed to worship Him in a loving way. And can we really say that we love Him if the only reason we're worshiping Him is because we feel that He's just whipping us along His path with a threat of judgment?
Mm-hmm. That is absolutely correct. And sadly, that's how people view God. To me, that's what you just said right there is the key to understanding Christianity itself. Because your atheist, your skeptic out here, that's what they're going to say. They're going to say, how can God be so mean and awful to demand things of us and ask us to do things? Whereas, as you said, if we love God, because God loves us, it's not, He's not whipping us along. We are in a relationship one with another. And you have to have love for God in that way, not just fear of punishment. It's deeper than that. That Christianity is deeper than just fear of punishment, fear of going to hell. Although we certainly don't want to do that. But it's bigger than that. And love is the motivation for that. Okay, let's move on to question number five. This will be for Bill. How does perfect love cast out fear, and what fears are cast out from verse 18?
Well, verse 18 says there's no fear in love. And if you think about being an IT guy or being an engineer or being a professional athlete, they train. They train, and then they have confidence to stand at the tee box on TV in front of a million people and hit a drive. Or they have confidence to go to their boss and say, I found this, and I think if we do this and this and this, we can save $50,000 for the company. Those kinds of things. So confidence, it drives away fear. Not completely, because the folks are still nervous and you still wonder if I'm saying the right thing to the boss or whatever, but confidence in what we're doing drives away fear. Perfect love casts out fear. Those who love have no fear. So what fears are cast out? Torment is mentioned, and I believe this fear is punishment everlasting. And not fear as in the beginning of wisdom, as we've talked a couple of different times. You know, Psalms 111 and verse 10 and is one example that comes to mind. So it's the beginning. I believe the fear mentioned here is everlasting judgment.
Excellent. Other comments here? Question number five?
I just start calling.
Yes.
Bill said Psalm 56, of course, the fear of judgment, but someone who loves like God, let me see here. Psalm 56:11, in God I have put my trust, I will not be afraid of what man do to me. So I think it, use other fears that, that kind of.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. That's a great verse. Yeah, Mark.
I don't think anybody else has mentioned Hebrews 4. But I think it might be a parallel. Hebrews 4, 14 and 16, seeing that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. So a group of people who are being tempted to fall away, like these people were being tempted by the Gnostics.
Mm-hmm.
We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So the idea is that Jesus sympathizes with our weaknesses, and as long as we are in him and faithful, then he sympathizes with our weaknesses, and that should cast out fear in our hearts. And the Gnostics, I think, obviously, they don't have that, because they're rejecting Christ and the truth, and so they should be afraid.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Other comments? I bring up this, these couple things here. The way Kaufman started out this, his comments on this particular verse, it bothered me a little bit. He said, the Apostle John here presents one after another all but impossible levels of Christian attainment. Now he goes on later in this particular section, and he kind of backtracks on that a little bit, and he ends by saying that, well, with Christ, then it's attainable. But that's not how he starts it out. He talks about not human attainment, but Christian attainment. I feel like that this is a common issue. I know it has been for me, and sometimes in lessons that I've heard in the past, people talk about verses like this, or be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect, and presented in almost a way where it's, how could I ever reach that? I'm never going to reach that. So basically, everything I'm doing here is just an exercise in futility. It's meaningless, because I'll never be able to reach that level. And I think that's the wrong way to look at Christianity. I think it's the wrong way to look at love, and particularly this type of love. The highest standards of Christianity are attainable. They are attainable for each and every person in this room. We can all reach this type of love that's talked about here in 1 John 4 and 18, where our fears are cast out, but only with the right attitude and the exemption, of course, of the wrong ones. And perhaps they look out of reach because we place something in front of them of ourselves that we know we will never move in order to attain them. And to me, that's what Hebrews 12 verse 1 talks about, where it says, laying aside the weight that so easily besets us. As we will see in the next chapter, chapter 5, verse 4, his commandments are not grievous, they're not burdensome. These standards are attainable. We can have this type of love, and it casts out fear. And I think Barnes said it very well. It's guilt that makes people fear what is to come, but he whose sins are pardoned and whose heart is filled with the love of God has nothing to dread in this world or the world to come. It's a great section here, but I thought that was particularly important. Other comments before we move on? Levi?
I think this is an important verse to get out in the air, because I think it relates a lot, because earlier in the chapter it also talks about the confession, and but I think, you know, when we hear these verses, you know, it kind of sets the expectation that we should, you know, almost be on cloud nine. But I want to mention Philippians 2, verses 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. So, obviously, it is important to not have an unhealthy fear of God. But I don't think as Christians we're not going to have, you know, as I mean, as these verses say, with fear and with trembling. I think that we need to have a healthy fear of God, but I don't think all the fear that a Christian should have of God is just from reverence. I think there is a healthy fear of judgment, and I think everyone would agree with that, but I just wanted to get those verses out there.
Appreciate that. Great verse. Let's move on, because we're about out of time here. Question number 6, this will be for Dennis. Why do we love God? Why is the love of God and our love of our and our love of our brethren connected? I could have phrased that better, but anyway.
Kind of answer this all in the same thing. My first thought was, this is a very correct response to our understanding and experiencing God's love through His Son Jesus and the tremendous sacrifice, sacrificial gift of Himself on our behalf. And it's also crucial that we must understand where we would be without that love. Understand what awaits those who don't go to heaven to be with the Lord. You have to understand that, you know, and deeply and fully appreciate the gift received, and then reciprocate that love back to God. Let me see. I think this, another way to do that, obviously, is loving our brother. God loved us first, obviously, what it says. Love comes from God. This act of love is the very nature of God. So God's nature is love. We abide in God, like it says. We therefore abide in love. And that love is poured out. It's kind of demonstrated the way we react to a brother. That's how you come up with it.
Excellent. Other comments?
I just have some verses to read from Matthew 25. And I don't read all of them, but verse 34 of Matthew chapter 25 reads, "Then the king will say to those on his right hand, 'Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of this world. For I was hungry and you gave me food, I was thirsty and you gave me drink, I was a stranger and you took me in, I was naked and you clothed me, I was sick and you visited me, and I was in prison and you came to me.'" And obviously, the righteous answer, when have we ever done these? He says, as long as you've done it to the least of these, you've done it unto me. And I think that is how our love is connected.
Mm-hmm. The same idea brought out in 1 John chapter 3, right? He who sees his brother in need and shuts up his bowels of mercy, how does the love of God dwell in him? Those are good verses. Obvious connection there and even into the judgment. Bill?
In Matthew chapter 22, verses 35 through 40, Jesus himself, he connected these two. 35 through 40. Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him, saying, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? To love God and then love your neighbor." So,
mm-hmm. I was thinking about this too, personally. I don't know how true it is, but I'll bounce it all off of y'all tonight. In many ways, I think this verse shows that loving each other is easier in many ways than loving God correctly. Because he makes the point here that how can he love God? Verse 20, "For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen?" It's easier, I think he's making the point that it's easier to love someone who you can see right in front of you, you can see their reactions in real time, you know immediately how you've hurt them or why you've hurt them, or how they've hurt you in return. All of those are known factors. And if you can't do that, how can you expect to love God correctly? Sometimes we get that backwards. Oh, I've got loving God down. I can love God all day long, but loving my brethren is so difficult. I find it so difficult so often. And I think this verse shows that in some ways we've got backwards. Loving each other should be not easy, but necessarily all the time, but in some ways I think it might be a little bit easier because no one is going to treat us worse than mankind is treating God. And God still loved us enough that he gave us his Son while we were yet sinners. So how can we say that we love God and find it so difficult to love our brethren? Any concluding comments? If not, let's wrap it up there. Appreciate everyone's really good study. And I know Bill, he was all prepared and ready to go with the moderation tonight, and so was I. So
I just did a coin flip on it, but we had some great comments, and I appreciate everyone so much.
Yeah.